I'm Bill Coogan, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Since this is the regular Friday night meeting of the Denver group, and we've been here for at least an hour and 10 minutes, and some of you for 2 hours, we will start this meeting by everybody standing up and saying hello to the one next door, to you, behind you, or anything, but just get up off your fannies and relax. You can tell you at an AA meeting there's so much chatter. You're a noisy bunch. Really, to stand up here before you and to look from one end of this vast auditorium to the other, it's awesome. I can think of no other word. And to all of you who are in the arena, how do I look on television? My wife told me to keep this very, very much on a high plane. And I can't help it, because my last name is Coogan, and the Irish have a sense of humor. And I wondered how you liked all the rest of those people marching down here with the fellow with the Irish flag. He said, "Let it begin with me," but it was in Gaelic. And since I'm four generations removed from Ireland, I don't know any Gaelic. But seriously, when you stop and think of 18,000 people here gathered in Denver and look back to the Kiel Auditorium, when the Third Legacy came into being, and our one remaining co-founder turned over the trusteeship to the conference, and the conference being your elected delegates, and you are AA. Had he not turned this back, but turned it over in his wisdom, and it wasn't only his, because he and Dr. Bob had talked on the 12 traditions and about the 12 traditions and having them accepted, and the first tradition in particular, which is our common welfare, shall come first, and personal recovery depends on AA unity. And if this isn't an example of AA unity, I don't know what is. Since there are so many people from Texas here, and not all of them ride horses, I know one rides a motorcycle, They get angry if you don't give your date of sobriety and think you're afraid of it. Mine is October 5th, 1957. I didn't say it for that reason. I was afraid of those Texans because I'm going there next month. A chairman is only supposed to really be a timekeeper. And I always say when they ask me to chair a meeting, generally, that if they wanted me to speak, they'd have asked me to be a speaker. But this meeting is composed of three speakers who are to have a half hour, and I was told to use 15 minutes in any way that I chose. So I have taken roughly 10 minutes, leaving 5 minutes for myself for rebuttal at the end, because I have three fine speakers, really. But before I introduce the first one, I would like to find out how many members of Al-Anon are here. Would you raise your hands, please? Beautiful, beautiful. Terrific. I am so glad because you people were so much sicker than we were. I mean that in a different way from which you people took it. We had a reason to be sick. That stuff we put down inside of us made us that way. And the next morning, sick, and sick in the head, and trembling and shaking and all the fears and everything else. But you people didn't do that. You were living with we nuts. And it must have been horrible. And I am so grateful for you people. You have done so much good for us. And I'm so proud of you. I don't want to cut that short, the clapping, because it could go on forever, but I want to say something about, I know there are a lot of Alateens here, and God love them. God love them. Every time I hear one speak, she just tears my heart to pieces. And I know what they must have put up with, because I have three beautiful sons. And I know what they must have gone through. And to you people, I'm so grateful. So very, very grateful for returning me a father. Back to those three boys. I told you, three speakers. All of them friends of mine. I've heard them, been with them places. And I admire all three of them. My first speaker is a fellow that I have known for some time. He comes from Saskatchewan. From Prince Albert in Saskatchewan. Cease C.
I guess let it begin with me. My name is Cease Corrigal, and I'm from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada, and I'm an alcoholic. A very good friend of mine by the name of Jack Sennon is speaking at Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada tonight. Now, you don't know where Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada is, and you probably don't know Jack Sennon. But that really doesn't matter. But he promised me that he'd mention my name up there if I'd mention his down here. Because of this beautiful program, And because of the many, many people like you people out there, and because of a loving God as I understand him, I haven't had to have a drink since January the 16th, 1952. And we only have a half hour tonight, so I can't tell you anything about my drinking story unless I tell you about the blackouts. But I can tell you I'm not here by mistake. I don't come this far by mistake. But I'm here because I drank too much booze and caused myself and a lot of people around me too much heartache. And because one night I was playing poker, and a great big fellow that weighed 275 pounds was a little narrow about something I did in a poker game, and I thought he weighed about 118. And he put his big fist in my big mouth, and I landed in hospital, and the little doctor, God bless him, told me that I should join Alcoholics Anonymous. And he brought Alcoholics Anonymous to me, and he brought two fellas to see me. And I got out of hospital, and I had a difficult time getting out of hospital because I'm a Protestant and I was in a Catholic hospital. And I'd given them a bad check for a private ward. And those little Catholic nuns are a little narrow about that. But I phoned my bootlegger, and he bailed me out. Because my credit was good with him. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, as I told you, January the 16th, 1952. And I was 27 years of age, and I was the youngest member in the whole province, and certainly the youngest member in my group, and it was just beautiful. People patted me on the back, told me I was doing a fine job, and I stayed sober simply by pats on the back. And then a horrible thing happened. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me, and they went and talked to the older members. And the older members walked right by me and went and talked to the newer members. And there I was out in the middle of the floor, and I was a middle member. And I felt like a hole in a donut. I was nothing. And I had ideas of going back out and trying it again and then coming back in and get all the pats on the back. But thank God I didn't have to do that. For you see, at that time, we had stayed sober by discussing the eighth step and then the first and working the first part of the first step and part of the 12th step where we carried the message. And really and truly, we didn't know too much about this program. And we had a fellow in our group that we asked to chair our discussion meeting. And he told us he would chair it, providing we did one thing. And we said, what is that? And he said, well, we are going to, as a group, go through the steps in sequence. And it doesn't matter who comes into the group. We're not going to go back to step one. We are going to take them by the hand, sponsor them properly, and we are going to do the steps as a group. His name was Ernie Sear. Ernie's now dead, so I break his anonymity. But I love that little guy, and I always will. Because he taught us, and we worked together, and we did the steps together as a group. And that is the experience that I am going to share with you tonight. Up until this time, I had admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. And when we started to go through the steps, I found out that there was a second part to this first step. It said that our lives had become unmanageable. And I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. I hate to even mention the small sum that I owed because it really doesn't impress people today because of inflation. But I owed $6,200 when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know in the United States and the other countries that's not a lot of money. But back in a little town by the name of Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, that is a lot of money. And in 1952, it was a great lot of money. And I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it. You see, I got here by way of a poker game. And I had an unmanageable life after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous as far as money was concerned. And I know none of you people out there, all 18,000, you none of you have had this problem. Whether you're in Al-Anon or Alateen or Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had it. After being in Alcoholics Anonymous for some time, I had a real good job. And my boss got a little sick and tired of the phone calls that he was getting and that I was getting during working hours. And he took me to the bank and he bailed me out. And we paid off the people that I owed money to. And he made me sign a paper that if I ever bought anything again, I would pay cash for it. 3 years later, he bailed me out for $7,500. For you see, I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. But I found out a strange thing, that financial problems has nothing to do with money. Think about that for a moment. It has a lot to do with big shotism. It has a lot to do with ego, and it has a lot to do with pride. I was the type of a guy, if I owed somebody $40, I wanted to pay them the $40. If I had $38, I would go out and try to make the other two, and I'd lose the 38. And I had problems. And financial problems cost me a lot more money, but it caused me to do many strange things. In Alcoholics Anonymous, where you're supposed to be getting well, it caused me to lie and to cheat and to tell people some horrible, horrible lies. But to show you that I've improved just a little bit, not too long ago, not too many years ago, I owed a manufacturer $10,000. Now, that's not a lot of money in my business, because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money in the middle of July when it's hotter than it was today. And this manufacturer was writing me some strange letters, and he was making some strange phone calls, and he was talking about padlocks on doors and sheriffs and things like that, and I decided I should write him a letter. And I wrote him a letter, and I told him how much I appreciated his merchandise. I told him that I would like fall dating on it. And then I threw a little philosophy at him. I said if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it would seem like a great distance. But if I was to take it one telephone pole at a time, perhaps it would take a little longer, but I'd finally get there. And I signed it, yours truly, Cecil E. Corgill, manager of the Cecil Corgill Fur Clinic, P.S. I am enclosing a certified check for $100. And I sent it away. A few days later, I got a letter, beautiful letter. He congratulated me on my letter-writing ability. He suggested that I get out of the fur business and go writing letters for somebody. And he signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel, Amsel and Amsel, Montreal. It's coming through the door now. And he said, P.S., would you mind sending me another telephone pole? I don't owe him any more telephone poles, but I could if I wanted to. And that's what I learned in that first step. But we went on to that second step, and it said, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And now they're telling me I'm crazy. I'd never been to a mental hospital. And so I thought, well, how can I come back from somewhere I hadn't been? And some of the old members took me aside and they said, Cease, it means restore you to sane thinking. And you are really not a sane thinker. As a matter of fact, you are a very negative thinker. And I agreed with them. For you see, I was stupid enough to do what they told me to do. And thank God I was stupid. And I would suggest if anybody in this program, whether you're an Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're real smart and you're having problems, get stupid. Because it helped me. So I found out in step one that I had an unmanageable life, and in step two I found a manager, and that's how simple it had to be. They told me to pray, and I said, who to? And they said, it doesn't matter, just pray. And so I did it. And it worked. But we went on to step three, and they told me that I had to make a decision. I don't know whether you people have any problems with making decisions, but they told me that I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood him. And I find out, as I rub shoulders with a lot of you beautiful people, that a lot of us have that problem of making decisions. Before I came up here tonight, I was trying to make a decision. I was trying to decide whether I should go to the bathroom or not. And right now, I don't know whether I've made the right decision or not. But in step one, I found out I had an unmanageable life. And in step two, I found a manager. In step three, I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this manager. And I did it this simple. I said, look it, I've done a lousy job. How about you taking charge? And I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's how I did it, and it worked. Talking about simplicity, I have a friend of mine back in Canada that has a ranch. And I like to keep everything simple. And I want to tell you this story why. Another friend, Mr. Amsel's over on that side now. Another friend said, how did you get the name of your ranch? And he said, well, I wanted to call it the Bar Q. My wife wanted to call it the Susie Q. My son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q. And my daughter wanted to call it the Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. And the guy said, that's a terrific name, but where are the cattle? And he said, none of them ever survived the branding. So you see, it doesn't pay to complicate things. So I found out I had an unmanageable life, and I found a manager in step two, and in step three, I turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager. That today I prefer to call God. And then they told me that I had to stop taking your inventory, and I had to start taking mine. That I had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And they told me that I had to write it down. And they told me the only thing that was tough about step four was getting a pencil. And then they said, write down right underneath it that you're a liar. And I had something wrong with me. And I went to page 65 of that big book, and it told me how to take step four. And I made that searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And I had to do it that simple. Just do it the way the book told me to do it, and not argue with it. And then I went on to step five, and it said that I had to admit to God, to another human being, to God and myself, another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. And I found out the only tough thing about step five was step four. After I'd done step four, I found out I wanted to do step five. I also found out that I'd done two-thirds of step five, because I'd admitted to myself and I'd admitted to another human being, or admitted to God. And now I had to go and to admit to another human being. And I found a little preacher. And I went and talked to him. And I thought I would shake him up, but I didn't. As a matter of fact, he shared a few things with me. He was sort of a little orangutan himself in his time. And I became very fast friends with this man. And I was really proud of myself. For I'd found out that I had an unmanageable life. And I found a manager. And I turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager. And then I went and talked. Went and took my own inventory and wrote it down in a paper, and then I went to talk to another human being, and I was real proud of myself. And then I went to step six. And in the 12 and 12 of step six, the first sentence says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I found out I had to be entirely ready to get rid of all of these defects of character. And believe me, I don't think that I wanted to. Because you see, I was afraid of becoming too good too fast. And if any of you out there are having that problem, don't worry about it. I was afraid of becoming a saint. Don't worry about that either. Because I'm privileged to be doing what I'm doing tonight many, many weekends. and meeting a tremendous amount of people, and I've never as yet met a saint, not even in Al-Anon or Alateen. But I had to be entirely ready, I found out, and I told you I was stupid, so I went along with that. I was entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then I had to go on, and I had to humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And I was a great fellow for telling, humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. To me, that means humbly prayed to God to remove my shortcomings. And I was one of these fellows that used to tell everybody how to pray. I told him to pray walking down the street, riding in an automobile, riding in an airplane, riding horseback, laying under bed. But I never, ever told anybody to pray by getting down on their knees, because I hadn't been down there myself since I'd been in Sunday school. But when I was delegate to New York in 57, 58, I think it was, I met a fellow by the name of Shy Walker, and I know some of you people remember dear old Shy. He's now passed away. And Shy told us a story one night at a meeting in New York of how he had a difficult time when he come out of prison of getting down on his knees to pray, and he so much wanted to stay sober. And he told us about how one night he came from work, and he had high-top boots on, and quite by accident he kicked his high-top boots underneath the bed. And then he told us that the next morning he got down to get his high-top boots from under the bed, and he said, "By golly, while I'm down here, I'm going to say a few words." And every night he used to boot his boots under the bed. And the next morning he'd get down there to say a few words. I don't know whether it works with high-top boots or not, but I know that it works with ordinary Oxfords, because I tried it. I don't have to do that anymore, because I can pray and get down on my knees. And if there is any definition of humility, to me it's as simple as this. It's the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. And I learned this through step 7. And then it told me that I had to make another list of all the people I'd harmed and become willing once again to make amends to them all. And I made this list with a pencil and a paper. And I put my own name up top, because I'd lost my self-respect in my own hometown. And I listed all of the other people that I'd harmed, every person that I could remember. And I went on to step 9. And it said, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I started to make these amends. And believe me, this is probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me in the AA program. For you see, it allowed me to walk free. I live in a little town, and the main drag is probably a half a mile long. But it used to be about 10 miles long before I made the amends. Because I'd start down the street, and I would see somebody coming that I couldn't meet, and I'd have to go to the other side. I'd see somebody coming there, and I'd have to duck to this side. Then I'd see somebody coming from both sides, and I'd have to go to the back alley. And this is a tough way to live, and it's hard work. And I don't want no part of that. And I started to make these amends, and I made them. And I made amends to people that didn't even know that I'd harmed them, because I had assassinated a lot of people's character to build myself up. I had knocked them down. And I had to go and apologize to them. And this is what I had to do in step 9. And I found out that by making these amends, as I said, it allowed me to walk free. And I'll be ever grateful that that beautiful step is in that program. Step 10 is probably the most beautiful step to me, because this is a step that allowed me to come back to you people when I'd never been away. After I'd been sober for 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. And I became a Central Avenue big shot. That's our main drag. And I became very interested in material things. And I got some of those material things. But in my great struggle to get them, I once again become spiritually poor, like I was when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never missed any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to every meeting, because I went with the wrong motive. I would walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sick thought, something like this: "You lucky people, here I am." And I know this will never happen to any of you people, but all I'm doing is telling you that this is what happened to me. And I had a big job, and I got fired from that big job. I went into the office one day with my boss, and I was managing the largest ladies' wear store in the province of Saskatchewan and looking after the fur department for 5 other stores. And we went into this big office of his, and it seems that our store wasn't quite big enough for the 2 of us. And it seems that he wasn't about to leave. and he fired the great Cease Corrigal. And I walked out of that store with an attitude something like this. Well, they won't last long now. I want you to know that they're still millionaires and they're doing pretty good. But about that time, a great thing happened to me. I had a little cousin from the west coast of Canada. Her name was Fern. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she came to see me. And I don't think that she just came to see me. I believe that she was sent by somebody bigger than us. And she arrived in my city, and she found me unemployed. And the year before, I'd written her a letter and told her about all of the big jobs I'd been offered. And she walked into Prince Albert, and I am unemployed. And I was going to a little roundup in the province of Manitoba that coming weekend. And a dear little fellow by the name of Dave Murray from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, who has now passed away, Dave came up to take me to this roundup. And I went downtown and I bought some brand new clothes. And I went down to see my little cousin. And I stood up in front of her in my big egotistical way. And I said, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And she said these few simple words, and I'm going to share them with you. She said, "You look real good on the outside, Cease. How are you really on the inside?" And I drove with this dear old gentleman, and he didn't talk to me because he knew that maybe Cease was looking at Cease once again. I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I spent 2 days in a hotel room with God, deciding what I should do with my future. And I went back to my hometown, and I went into business for myself. But I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous with the right motive, and I'd never missed any meetings. I started doing institutional work once again with the right motive, and I hadn't stopped doing that. Because that little girl said those few simple words to me. Step 11 to me is probably the step that I am so grateful that I can understand. For it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. The very fact that I can say that is a miracle. The fact that I understand it is a bigger miracle. But the fact that I can take simple prayer and know what it is to me, I don't know what it is to you. But prayer to me is just talking to a loving God as I understand Him. Meditation is shutting my big mouth and listening for answers. And that's the way that I understand the first part of step 11. And step 11, I think, is so beautiful because it says praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I don't know about you people, but sometimes I like to take it back and start running the show again. Not too many years ago, I did that. One of these ladieswear stores that I got fired from came up for sale. And I thought, what a beautiful thing it would be if I could buy this. Get my picture in the paper and on television and radio. The store that I got fired from. And I once again become the owner. And I thought that would be beautiful. And I set up a company, and naturally I was president of the company. We bought the store, and I was manager of the store. And I built the thing up 3 times to what the volume used to be and went bankrupt. And I don't know whether any of you people have ever gone bankrupt, but I did. I don't know whether any of you have ever gone to bankruptcy court, but I did. And the morning that I was going to bankruptcy court, there's one of your new trustees that I sponsored, taught him everything he knows. Max C., the brand new trustee. Not only that, he beat me out, you know. And I'm trying to stand here without any resentment because I thought they should have introduced me tonight. But Max phoned me at 7:30 in the morning I was going to bankruptcy court, and he was laughing on the phone, 600 miles away. And he said, "Old buddy, I was just thinking something." And I said, "What were you thinking?" And he said, "Maybe God decided that you shouldn't be in the ladies' wear business." And he hung up. You don't need people like that when you're going to bankruptcy court. But I believe today that God did decide that I shouldn't be there because I'm pretty happy without being there. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And this step has taught me many, many, many things. Each and every morning, I have a little room in my home where I go in and I read page 86 and page 87 of the big book. I read page 164, page 63, and other parts of the big book. And in page 86, it tells me that I should talk with my rabbi, my priest, or my preacher, and find out some other good literature. And I found this other good literature, and I read that too. And I had a beautiful thing happen to me a few years ago. I have a little granddaughter that lives in eastern Canada. And sometimes when I'm on a trip, something like this, I take my little granddaughter home with me on the airplane. And the first day that she was home, I went in to do my reading in the morning, and she was up. And she knocked on the door, and her grandmother said to her, "You can't go in there. Gramps is doing his reading." And she said, "Well, I have something to tell him." So I said, "Let her come in." And she came in, and I took her up on my knee, and I tried to explain to her what I was doing. And after I finished, I said to her, "Now, what did you want to tell me?" And she said, "I just wanted to tell you that I love you." And I said, "Well, I want to tell you that I love you too." I don't know whether that means anything to you, but it means a great deal to me. Because when I came to you beautiful people, I wasn't capable of accepting anybody's love. And I certainly wasn't capable of returning it. But I can with this beautiful little girl. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And I find that power many, 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 many ways. And then it told me in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I told you I was stupid, but I figured it out that a spiritual awakening to me was just a personality change. And the very fact that I could have it by going through these 11 previous steps in sequence, I could have it. And I was able to get it by going through those steps. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I would like to share with you a beautiful story about a great actor that was asked to say the 23rd Psalm. And he went home and he rehearsed it in front of the mirror and he rehearsed it on a tape recorder. And he was asked to say it in front of a big audience, something like this. The Sunday before he was supposed to say it, he went to church and he heard his minister say the 23rd Psalm. The great night arrived and this great actor stood up in front of these thousands of people and he said the 23rd Psalm the way any great actor could say it, just beautiful. And when it was all over, he received a standing ovation. He went back up to the microphone and he asked the people to sit down. And he said, "I have a favor to ask you." For he says, "I have a friend of mine, a minister friend of mine in the audience, and I'd like him to come up here and say the 23rd Psalm." His minister friend came up and said the 23rd Psalm the way it's supposed to be said. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," but he said it from the heart and not just from the mouth. And when it was over, there was no big standing ovation. There was tears in many, many people's eyes. And the great actor once again went up to the microphone and he said, "You see the difference between my minister friend and myself is that I know the sheep, but he knows the shepherd." And isn't it beautiful that in our beautiful program that we get to know both the sheep and the shepherd? And let us never forget it, because it's beautiful to know both the sheep and the shepherd. And then it says, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic that still suffers. All we can do is try. But let's make a good effort. Let's look good when we get the opportunity to try. I once heard a story about a fella that got up one morning and he didn't like the way his wife cooked the eggs or something, and he slammed the door and he went out and he jumped in his car and he went away to work. And he drove down, and he was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he drove down one side of the street and he shook hands at everybody, shook his fist at everybody, and he was driving other cars. And he told him to get out of his way, and he'd come to a stop sign. The moment the old green light went on, he'd honk the horn, and he just went to work all tensed up and miserable like this. Finally, he got to work, and he treated everybody at work the same way. That night, he drove home the same way. Drove everybody else's car but his own. He got home. He didn't want supper. He went into the television room. He told the kids to turn the television off. He wanted to read the paper. Sorry, I didn't see it. It just went on? I'm real sorry I didn't see it, Bill. Honestly. My time's up. Let it begin with me. Anyway, he went out and he fell asleep in his television room and he got a call to go out on a 12-step call. And he said, why did they call tonight? And he jumped in his car again and he drove it the same way through traffic and cursing and swearing and everybody. Finally, he got to this house where this poor fellow was having trouble. And the poor guy is sick and he's laying on a bed. And the guy sat down beside him. And you know what he said? If you want what we have. Who in the hell would want that? And I hope that when we make our 12-step calls that we don't do it that way. And I've seen a great amount of unity in this beautiful program this weekend. I've seen so many people working together. And I would like to close with a story about unity. Back in Canada one time, a young couple took their little boy and they went out into a big wheat field. And they were looking at this big wheat field of theirs and their little boy crawled away and became lost. And they looked all over for him and they went and called the neighbors in and they searched and they went in all different directions and they tried to find the little boy and they couldn't find him. And they called the army in. And the next morning, this army sergeant said, let's join hands and walk across the wheat field. And this way we won't miss them. And they joined hands and they walked across the wheat field. And they found the little boy, and he died of exposure during the night. And his daddy picked him up in his arms, and he said, why didn't we join hands before? That's what we've been privileged to do. That's what I've been privileged to do. To join hands with you beautiful people and walk in unity with you and with a loving God as I understand him. And I want to thank the committee for allowing me this very beautiful privilege of being with you on this great night in Denver. And I want to close this talk the way that I close every talk that I've ever given. And I hope that it'll help somebody as much as it helped me. Each and every one of you look real good on the outside. How are you really on the inside? Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you, Cease. We have a system of lights up here that the engineer didn't fix very well. They were underneath the podium and Cease couldn't see it. We have a yellow light when you got 5 minutes and a red light, shut up. And Cease couldn't see the lights. I know he couldn't because they were underneath. I have just moved the red light so that our next two speakers can see them. I apologize for the electrician. Our next speaker, I know you love her. Her name is Holly Martin from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Holly.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Holly Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. I am very happy, extremely grateful to be here. Very grateful. I think I would have hijacked Jonathan Seagull to get here. I wanted to come so badly. And I certainly do not want to spend my few precious moments standing here taking the time to qualify for this program for the simple reason is if there is nothing wrong with you when you first come here, there will be if you stay long enough. That is for sure. I want to tell you more or less what the program has done for me and what it means to me. Anything less than that is what Shakespeare says, a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. You see, I don't need to stand here all evening to tell you that I know what it means to wake up at 6 o'clock. The clock says 6 and you don't know what 6 it means, you know. You don't know whether it's 6 in the evening or 6 in the morning, and you're scared to ask anybody because they might say to you, are you just now coming in, or what are you getting up so early for? So you just lay there. You'd like a drink of water, but you're scared to get up and get it. You finally have to go to the bathroom, and you're scared to go, so you suffer at both ends. You just lay there. I know what it means to take things that you love to the pawn shop and get rid of them. Oh, you swear you'll never do this again. I had a watch that stayed in the pawn shop so much it wouldn't run on a Jewish holiday, you know. I know what it means to insult your gut. I know the insanity of that morning drink. When you wake up and you haven't even been asleep yet, and you want to drink so bad, and every time you take one, your stomach says, I said don't send that mess down here, and it sends it right back up again. And you send another down, and your stomach says, you heard what I said. Your mind finally refuses to cooperate and says, I don't care what you do. And finally you send one down and it stays, and then you have the insanity to say, oh my gracious, I finally got one to stay down. And you're real happy about it. And that is the insanity of insulting your intestines, you know. This went on with me for a number of years, more years than I care to really talk about. So finally one night, sitting in my kitchen, I heard a story come on over the radio. It was called The Glass Crutch. I did not turn the story on, or the radio on rather, to this particular station, because when you're in the stage that I was in at that particular time, you don't need to turn the radio on for anything. You hear voices all the time anyway. It doesn't make any difference. But this story came on, and it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. And this is a story that haunted me down through the years, 6 or 7 years before I finally picked up that phone. All I can remember about the story was about a woman that had a drinking problem. And said, if you ever need our number, we'll be the first number in the book. If you ever need our help, rather. Well, I thought, I don't need these people. If there's anything wrong with Holly, I can straighten it out myself. And wine was straightening me out each and every day. But this story, haunting me and haunting me, till finally, that day came. The clock on the wall had said to me many times, instead of tick-tock, tick-tock, it had said, the glass crutch, the glass crutch. Many times walking down the street, the heel plates on my shoes would beat out the words, the glass crutch. Finally, one day, sitting there with this glass in my hand trying to read the newspaper, it seemed as if every word on that paper said, the glass crutch. So finally, I said, my Lord, what is this? And as my eyes left that newspaper and fell on my hand, it dawned on me, Holly, you can't even read the newspaper without the glass crutch. Finally, I did call. But, you know, I was a little dubious about it. If someone had told me they'd stayed sober 6 weeks, I could have believed that. If they said they stayed sober 6 months, I don't think so. If they said 6 years, I said, uh-oh, they got to be lying. I knew that. People didn't stay sober 6 years. That I knew. But do you know, kind as my sponsors were to me, they were very exacting. And I hated all of them, all four of them. I hated them. And one of the things that made me hate them so badly was one of them constantly read that who me to me. You know? She'd look at me and she'd say, just answer yes to three, dear, and you're in. Just answer yes to three. And I thought this old biddy must be getting 50 cents a year, you know, or something like that. See? And I thought they were the stupidest questions that I'd ever heard in my life. You know, is drinking clouding your reputation? Well, I thought if you've been in a fog 27 years, how do you know whether it's cloudy or not? What difference does it make? And then she would read the other one over. She'd say, do you seek a lower environment while drinking? I thought, no, I do not seek a lower environment while drinking. I merely created a lower environment while drinking. And the craziest question of all to ask any alcohol, do you prefer to drink alone? If I'm buying it, yes. If you're buying it, no. I thought that those were about the silliest questions that any human being could ask another. You see, I felt about these women, and one of them was a man. He's around here somewhere. But nevertheless, I felt about these women. I was scared of them. And I didn't want them to go. Well, I felt about them like most men feel about their wives. I wish you'd go away and leave me alone, but don't go so far I can't find you if I need you, you know. That's the way I felt about them, see. But anyhow, it seems I can remember one of them telling me, and she constantly told me, Howie, you're going to have to change your attitude. That's all that's wrong with you. You're going to have to change your attitude. Well, I thought that there was nothing wrong with my attitude because everybody that I'd ever met in my life's attitude was wrong except mine. Even before coming in, people used to say the stupidest things. It was their attitude. They used to say, you need somebody, you need help with your drinking. I thought, I don't need no help with my drinking. I can do it all myself. I don't need anybody to help me. That was the attitude that I had. But finally, coming, meeting after meeting, the most important thing that there is in my life today, other than trying to help another alcoholic, I found a set of attitudes. Beatitudes. The most beautiful attitudes that has ever been given to this world. And I liken those beatitudes with these wonderful 12 steps that we have. And when I think of that first step where we admit that we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable, I identify that with the beautiful beatitude that tells me, blessed are the poor in spirit, that I am really blessed because I can admit that I'm powerless over alcohol. Blessed because no more arrogance, that I have become teachable. Poor in spirit doesn't mean what I thought it meant, that I must cringe and that I must crawl. It meant that I must become teachable. And this is exactly what it meant to me. And then I looked on a little further in a change of attitude. And there was another beautiful attitude that told me this. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, if you don't like the word mourn, you simply don't have to use it. You can use the word yearn. Blessed are they that yearn, for they shall be comforted. And I identified that beautiful beatitude with the second step that tells me I came to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. How many times hadn't I sat there in that kitchen of mine or on some bar stool? And did I not yearn for a better way of life? Did I not mourn? How many times did I not pick up this bottle or this glass and I'd say to myself, is this all there is in life for me, God? Were we not yearning and mourning for a better way of life? All it was in me. Sometimes we find the second step as we say, well, you know, I can't buy that. Well, my friends, anytime you so much as buy a can of beer, you're buying a power greater than yourself or you wouldn't be buying it, you know. Anytime I pick up that shot glass, that's a power greater than me. And oh, how long I yearned for a better way of life. And this yearning and yearning of mine, I realized, had I not sat there, you see, man's adversity is God's opportunity. Had I not sat there yearning for a better way of life, tonight I wouldn't be here with you, my dear ones, that is for sure. And then I looked at the third step. Blessed are meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And I identified that with the third step, where we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And I thought, meekness, oh no, uh-uh. You know, after all, meekness, that's chicken. And finally it dawned on me, it's better to be the chicken than what comes out of the end of the chicken. Let's be a little meek, my friend, you know? method of me. And meekness, my friends, I found out was not weakness. It was simply strength that is harnessed. Because you and I have a great deal of strength. But always it's used in the wrong way. And here it was. Strength harnessed by the grace of God. Then I looked at inventory, my friends. Long, not right away, but it took a little time. And I identified that fourth step, inventory, where we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and I identified that with a beautiful beatitude, a different kind of attitude. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Now, if you don't like the word righteousness, don't let it scare you to death. It simply means right thinking. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after right thinking, for they shall be filled. But anything, my friends, that is to be filled must first be emptied up. It has to be emptied out. It's simply like a tooth, you know, that is decayed. Regardless of how much filling you put into the tooth, unless the decay is cleaned out, my friends, that the filling is not going to stay. And how many times don't you and I have the same problems over and over because we haven't got rid of the decay that was there, you know? And many times I think of this fourth step in relationship with the story of the prodigal son. Here was a young boy. Here was a boy that had to be emptied out, you know? You see, he had reached that stage in life when he wound up in that pig pen, the kind of mental, physical, and spiritual pig pen that Holly wound up in. And as a book of books where all of these 12 steps came out of it, it says, and no man gave him nothing. Did you ever reach that stage in your life when no man gave you anything? Nothing. When you went anywhere you went, somebody said, here comes Holly, hide the whiskey. You know, you'd reach that point in life. And here's where we find our boy, you know. Here's where we all find ourselves, and no man gave him nothing. Can't you feel that emptiness up there? That loneliness when no man gave him nothing. And then the book of books goes on to tell me, and he finally came to himself. And that's when I took an inventory, when I finally came to myself. And like the prodigal son, I wanted to go home, even if I'd never been there, because I finally came to myself. But I realized, like him, I had to be emptied up of something. The first thing that I had to be emptied up of, like him, was my pride. I'm sure in my mind's eye I can see him as he laid there in that pig pen. Oh, yes, it would be very easy to get up and say, well, I think I'm going on home, you know, taking everybody and everything for granted. But, oh, no, he had a conscience like you and I have. He had to think about this thing. He had to come to himself. He realized I've got to be emptied up of my pride, like I realized I had to be emptied up of my pride before anything could take the place of it. You know, this pride that says, well, you know, I'm in a mess, but I don't want to admit it. I had to be emptied up of that kind of pride, you know. I had to be emptied up of my resentment, you know, in this inventory of mine. I'm very sure that the prodigal son might have said as he laid there in this pig pen, well, you know, my father's servants are living better than I am. And he could have laid there and resented them. But, oh, no, he had to be emptied up. How many times don't you and I have this old ugly resentment that we have to be emptied up of? Well, so-and-so is staying sober, you know. And he hadn't gotten near what I got, but he's staying sober. You know, and we resent the living daylights out of him because he's staying sober. And you figure, well, what's he doing sober? I hate him because he's sober. How can he do it? He don't have what I have. He's very glad that he don't have what you have, you know. So like that boy, I had to be emptied up of my resentment. I had to be emptied up of my phoniness. Very well, mightn't the prodigal son have said, well, I'll just go on back home and I'll tell him, you know, I don't have to live this way. I was just living this way for kicks. But, you know, like him, I had to be emptied up of this phoniness. I couldn't come to anyone and say, well, you know, I don't have to live this way. I just drink wine for kicks. You ain't never heard of nobody puking for kicks, have you? Never in your life, you know. I had to be emptied up of all of this phoniness of mine. I had to be emptied up of my self-pity. The kind of pity that would make me think, I can't understand how come everybody else can go out and get drunk and have a good time, and I go out and I take two drinks and I get drunk, and tomorrow night I might go out and drink everybody under the table, you know. But you see, I had learned that alcohol was cunning, baffling, and powerful, you know. And it allowed no room for self-pity, because I was one individual and somebody else. And they had told me, don't compare, identify, you know. And I had to be emptied up of feeling. Well, you know, if I get bored, I know exactly what to do, you know. Because when we get bored, we all know that I can only stand just so much of this. Bored. How many times haven't you and I heard someone say, well, you know, I had trouble because I got bored. Well, they told me in AA that action is the magic word, not boredom. And if I stayed active, I wouldn't be bored. And to me, that's silly. I got to get drunk because I'm bored? If you got constipated, you wouldn't go out and buy a stick of dynamite, would you? No, it's just as simple. This just wouldn't happen, you know? And I realized that this self-pity of mine that I could entertain for so long, you know, would only, along with self-pity, had to go self-knowledge, everything that I thought that I knew so much about. It had to go along with all of this self-sufficiency that I had. Because I realized that all of these things, my friend, would only lead to self-delusion. And then I realized, of all things, the thing that haunts most of us day and night is those awful fears that we had. And I had to be emptied up of these fears. This fear of rejection that many times we can have. Well, if I don't drink, I won't be accepted. In other words, I've got to kill myself on installment plans to get along with people, you know. Because if I don't drink, where will I go? What will I do? And I had to be emptied up of this fear of not being accepted, that I wouldn't be rejected. But the very simple reason is, I knew that I had to start somewhere, and I had to take my chances, and it had to start with me. And then I began to think, you know, after all of this emptying up process, that the prodigal son had to go through, that he went through, that he put himself through because he took an inventory, you know. And then I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do about this amends bit? Because this is one of the things that I still, the last thing to leave a man or a woman and the first thing to which he's restored to is his ego. What am I going to do about making amends? Well, you know, maybe there's some way that I can skirt around it. But, you know, there was a step there that told me about amends. There was two of them that told me about amends. And there was one change of attitude, you know, that says to me, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. So I knew then that I was going to have to make amends. And I was going to have to start somewhere, and that was going to have to start with me. That was the beginning of it, right then and there, starting the amends with me. See? Because I realized, in order to be a peacemaker, if I did not live with peace with myself, peace with anybody else would be sheer hypocrisy. So that too, my friends, had to start with me. And then, my friends, I began to feel, well, you know, after all, if I keep on this way, you know how we can talk to ourselves when we get alone, I'm going to be ridiculed. People are going to make fun of me. You know how we can feel that from time to time. Not when we're around our buddies, but when we're by ourselves. How do I know if I start this amends bit, I won't be ridiculed? But then, there was a change of attitude there as I looked at that tenth step that told me to continue to take an inventory. There was a tenth step, and I looked at it, continue to take a personal inventory. And I identified that, my friends, when I thought of the ridicule that I might have to face, that blessed are they that are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for right thinking. But you know, my friends, I realized the one thing. Blessed are they that are persecuted for right thinking. I realized that there was nobody on the face of this earth that could ever persecute me the way that that wine bottle had persecuted me. I knew that regardless of where I went, and regardless of whatever situation that I might find myself in, that nothing on earth could ever persecute me the way that I had, of the things that I had done to myself. And I realized that one thing, that as long as I tried one day at a time, and your arms were around me, and his eyes were upon me, that I could stand tall and say with Paul, I fought the good fight, I finished my course, I kept the faith. God bless you.
Thank you, Holly. We have one more speaker. He, too, is a good friend of mine. And I won't take any of his time. Thank you, Holly. I didn't have to use any lights on you. You saved me some energy with my fingers. If you wonder why some of us do not laugh at things that are funny, when you hear them out there, it's because the speakers are turned out that way and we miss it back here. I just thought I'd try to explain that to you in case you thought we were all frozen faces up here. The last speaker, and a very dear friend of mine, is from Riverside, Illinois. That's a suburb of Chicago, I think. Paul Martin.
Thank you, Bill. Good evening. My name is Paul Martin. I'm a young alcoholic in an old container. Hi. It's been a long night. I'm going to talk fast and short. Alcoholism is a disease. AA is my answer. And I'm grateful to be here and be sober. This is the biggest crowd I've seen since the last time Corrigal had a fur coat sale. Next month, on August 15th, I'll have 28 years of sobriety in AA, and I mention that only because I'm bragging. Somebody has said that an old-timer in AA is a guy who's sober so long he's afraid the new man might throw up on him. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that this is where I belong, and I'm going to have to keep working. I have many good friends sitting here this evening, and I'm grateful for your friendship. As I'm grateful for the chance to be here, I'm grateful to my old friend, the round square from Winnipeg, Tom Breen, who gave me some hair grower a while back. He used it for 6 months. I only grew one hair, but it weighed 8 pounds. Years ago, when Tom was drinking, he went out on a trip one time on a ship, and the ship sank. And there was a sailor rowing around in a rowboat, and he was going around and grabbing all of the people in the water by the hair, and he'd pull them into the boat, and he'd row up alongside of another one and pull them into the boat. Rowed up alongside where Breen was bobbing up and down in the water. He looked for a few minutes, and he whacked him over the head with an oar. He says, "Go back down and come upright." I grew up in a little town down in southern Georgia. The town was so dull that if you took LSD, you'd have had visions of Lawrence Welk. When I was very young, I figured out that alcohol was going to change my life. I used to put Vitalis on my head. I should have drunk that, too. I was the only kid in the third grade that looked like he was going to school on the GI Bill. But I found that when I drank the right amount, alcohol changed my life. And it really did. And I went back and drank and drank, and my life changed, and finally it changed so much that I wound up here with you. I'm grateful for many things, and one of them is that I don't have to take those gagging exercises in the morning anymore. I have no nostalgia for anything that comes with booze. I'm very grateful that alcohol ran me into AA. I'm very grateful that I found this way of living. And I'm very grateful that gradually and slowly, maybe I'm learning to stop trying to be smarter than I actually am. Spent a number of years after I sobered up as a retarded mystic. I was confused by the simplicity in this program. I read everything I could find on advanced approaches. I finally realized that what had happened was I developed a metaphysical hernia. I strained myself spiritually. And I went back and I took some more looks at this program. And I began to figure out that how it works means that this is how it works. Yeah, it took me a while. Page 562 in the big book, it says, I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I need, I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that this was just what I wanted all the time. And this was my experience, and it is my experience day after day. The only things I know about living I've learned from you people in AA. I drank my way through high school, played all the sports. I was a mediocre student. I wanted to be middleweight champion of the world, and I would have been, but I had a bad handicap. I couldn't whip anybody. World War II came around. I went into service. Finally became a pilot after I had been through the flight training program about as long as you could be in it without falling out of it. I had a unique war record. I destroyed two aircraft in World War II, and both of them belonged to the United States Navy. A friend of mine pointed out that if I'd gotten three more, I would have been a Japanese ace. In 1945, I wound up in a Navy hospital with pneumonia, which went into DTs. That ain't funny when it's happening to you, buddy. I was 23. I was 25 when I came into AA. It makes me 53 now. You're probably surprised to find I'm that old. But I am getting to be too old to take yes for an answer. But I didn't learn anything in a hospital. I was in there 4 weeks. I got drunk 9 out of the last 10 nights I was a patient in the hospital. We had two other drunks in the room where I was. One of them was a pilot in the photo squadron. He was brought in at 2:30 in the morning, drunk. He'd been swimming, cut his big toe open on a piece of submerged metal, and he came in with a young lady that we assumed was his wife. The next day, his wife showed up, and it was somebody else. The rest of the time I was in the hospital, his wife and his girlfriend came in to visit him, and they never met. I just figure that proves that if you live right, the Lord will take care of you. After I'd been in AA a few years, I met a man who said he was celebrating 2 years of sobriety. He said, when I came in this program, I had a drinking problem and a marriage problem. AA straightened out my drinking problem. My sponsor ran off with my wife, which straightened out my marriage problem, so this program will work if you let it. I guess somebody else had the same experience. It was then that I began to have a spiritual awakening. I got out of the service in World War II. I wound up at the air station in Norfolk. I came back to Chicago and December 8, 1945, I got separated from the Air Force up at Great Lakes Naval Station in Waukegan. I traveled for 3 days and three nights and got home to Oak Park where I was living, which is about 50 miles away. And I decided I better do something about my drinking, but after the first of the year, and I went up to Milwaukee to have a few drinks over New Year's, and I was drunk for 3 days. Drank myself sober on New Year's morning, and I came back on the train, and I had one of those paralyzing hangovers. Somebody would have said hello. It would have taken me 30 minutes to think of an answer. And I knew I had to do something because I'd wound up with what had to be the worst-looking woman in the Middle West. She looked like the centerfold in Dog World. She looked like $1 million, and the only reason I say that is because I've never seen $1 million, and she looked like something I never saw before. I came in today, and I saw those 20 questions. They said, do you seek lower companions when you drink? I said, buddy, you bet. Then I began to realize I not only sought them, I had become a lower companion. But I decided to go on the wagon, and I did a little boxing. I can't say I was going to make a comeback because I'd never been anywhere. But I got in shape, and I had a few fights and got my nose broken. And mid-February, a friend of mine and I went up to Glenview to fly at the air station, and the field closed in with a snowstorm, and we went into Chicago to have a few drinks. And he passed out, and I started to take him home. He lived in a place called St. Charles, which is about 35 miles west of Chicago. And I drove out North Avenue and I asked for directions in saloons along the way. I'd buy a bottle of beer and I'd get back in the car and I'd drink the beer. And about the time that was gone, I had forgotten the directions. And then I'd get another bottle of beer. And I walked into one of these places. There was a large dog on the floor and I said, hi, and the dog bit me on the leg. And I didn't think anything of that. Finally got my friend home, and a couple of days later, I went to see the doctor because my nose had been broken somewhere that evening. And I accidentally mentioned that I'd been bitten by this dog. He said, "You find that dog." So I went back to these saloons, and I said, "Did you have a dog that bit me the other night?" They said, "No." So I had to take rabies shots for 2 weeks. Just to be on the safe side, I made out a list of people to bite in case they didn't work. And I began to try to find answers in reading, and I read a book by a New York psychiatrist, Charles Spencer Coles, and he said we become alcoholics because we have too much pressure on our brains. He said this makes us compulsive drinkers and gives us very bad personalities, and I qualified on both points. He said the answer is you make a spinal tap and it relieves the pressure. You're no longer a compulsive drinker and you have a beautiful personality. Well, I knew there was a lot of pressure on my brain because all my hair was flying out. So I wrote him and asked him if anybody around Chicago could tap my head for me, and he said no. So I bought another book, and I got Rabbi Liebman's Peace of Mind. And I thought, what a magnificent volume, and then somebody told me he committed suicide. So I got rid of that. And I got Dorothea Brandy's Wake Up and Live. And that inspired me. She said, act as if it's impossible to fail. And then one day I tried that with the dry heaves. And I read everything I could find. Seal and Peel and Link and Fink, and they all had one thing in common. They didn't do anything for me. I finally called AA in August of 1947. And I went to my first meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. Can you imagine that? I started going to these meetings at two handicaps in AA. I come from a long line of Lutheran ministers. By the time I came on the program, I was a fallen away atheist. In spite of that, I believe in God today. But I had too much religious education and too much secular education. I got educated way beyond my intelligence. And this has continually gotten in the way of my AA growth. I was very grateful when I started to go to these meetings that I found that nobody in AA argued about whose higher power was higher. The way I'd been brought up, they said, if you don't believe this way, son, you're going to be a participant in an eternal marshmallow roast and you're liable to be one of the marshmallows. And that made quite an impression on me. But I started working these steps, and I heard that you work the first 9 steps once and then you work 10, 11, and 12, and I did that for quite a while. And then I heard that there were benefits in reworking all of these steps periodically. And I thought, well, why don't you try it? And I began redoing every one of these steps with some frequency. And I found there's a great difference between taking a periodic spot check inventory in step 10 and taking a thorough written inventory in 4. And then talking to another person thoroughly and honestly about myself and periodically relisting my defects of character and asking God to take them away and checking over my amends. And I began to see that everything I need is here, that all I have to do is follow these directions. I don't have to be smart. I don't have to develop my personality. All I have to do is work these steps as you have shown me. Because everything I know about AA, I've learned from you, and I've learned very slowly. And I try to follow the directions today. I belong to a step group. It's the Riverside Tuesday Night Young People's Group. We don't let anybody in there over 95. But we take a step every week, 1 through 12, and when we get to 12, we go back through 1. Do you know in that group, everybody is working these steps on a lifetime assignment, I believe. So that we're not talking about the fourth step we took years ago. We're talking about fresh work in this program, and it's a totally different thing. And I find that just by following these directions, I do get everything I need. But I know that I have to stay with you, because it's from you people that I've learned these things that have transformed my life, very often in spite of myself. If I were in a plane flying at 30,000 feet, it caught on fire, and somebody rushed up to me with a parachute, and he said, put this on, go through that escape hatch, pull the ripcord and save your life, what do you suppose I would do? Would I say, let's discuss the philosophical implications of this situation? Or would I say, nobody's going to tell me what to do? Or would I go through the hatch without a chute hollering, this is an individual program? Well, you know what I'd do? I'd follow the directions and hope the chute worked. As he used to say in the paratroopers, it don't mean a thing if you don't pull that string. About a year and a half ago, I was doing an article on alcoholism, and I called a friend of mine who's research professor of psychology at the University of Illinois, Obert Maurer. He knows a great deal about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's a great admirer of our program. I said, Hobart, what do you think of psychotherapy for the sober alcoholic in AA? And he said, if the alcoholic will use the 12 steps and develop the possibilities of fellowship within this program, this will be far more effective than any psychotherapy I know anything about. And what he witnesses to are... And what he witnesses, too, are three fundamental points. Number one, AA enables drunks to stay sober. Number two, the 12 steps are specifically designed to deal with what's wrong with you and me when we don't drink. And number three, AA does this far better than anything else on the scene today. If I want to get a reading on the benefits of counseling or therapy, it's useful for me to remember that AA is where the clergymen come to find God's help to stay sober, and it's where the psychologists and psychiatrists come to find the kind of group therapy that will bring sobriety and order to their lives. If the quality of my life is not what it should be, the best place for me to go for counseling or therapy is to the Big Book or to an AA member who has done enough continuing work with these steps to understand that how it works means that this is how it works. Being here is a tremendous experience for me. I was at the dance last night, and I didn't play any gavotte, so I didn't do too well. But, you know, I looked at all these people, and I thought, my God, what good fortune you and I have to be in touch with this tremendous thing that started with those amateurs in 1935, 40 years ago. And that's what the AA message is, a message from one amateur to another amateur. By... By all means, let's be friendly with our friends, but in the process, let's never forget what really helps alcoholics, and what really helps alcoholics is this fellowship and continuing persistent work with every one of these 12 steps. Because the longer I'm in AA, the more I find that everything I need is here. And when I work with a drunk, all I try to do is help him to experience what I continue to find by using every one of these 12 steps, by working these 12 steps. I don't try to function as a counselor or a therapist or a spiritual guide, but simply as one beggar telling another beggar where there is bread. Everything is here, and the message is summed up in the promises on page 82 and 83. Here's what you and I have available if we'll just do this work. You know, it's sometimes said that if you want to hide anything from an AA member, the best place to put it is in the Big Book, and I'm afraid that might be true. But here's what you and I have. If we work these steps, we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. I'm grateful to be here with all of you. It's a tremendous opportunity for me to recommit myself to these 12 steps and these principles and this fellowship as the finest place for an alcoholic to go to find everything that he needs to live, not just soberly, but to live with the meaning and the freedom and the joy that all of us searched for. And where does it start? Let it begin with me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. This has been more or less of a typical AA meeting of the Denver Friday night group. For those of you who may be new and have been brought to this large convention, or those of you who are non-alcoholics, or non-Al-Anons, or non-Alateens, what we do here is to try to tell a little bit about what we were like before, what we were like when we drank, and the recovery, and this is what you have heard. And you have seen pretty much of a cross-section here. You have seen Cease from Canada, who had a lot of trouble with alcohol, and then got sober, and then is in the fur business, selling furs in July. And you saw Holly and heard Holly from Michigan. And she just informed me she's a grandmother. I knew she was a housewife. But this is the distaff side, the female side that we have. Because this is a disease that cuts across sections. And it affects males and females. And it affects all people in all walks of life. And then you heard Paul, who by his own words is educated far beyond his mental capacity. Don't let him fool you. I have read some of his articles, and they are tremendous. He is in the marketing and communications field, whatever that means, but that's what he has on his card. But you have seen and heard the trouble that he had in his wonderful recovery. Now, I did tell you my name was Bill Coogan in the beginning, and I didn't tell you from where I came. And if you look on the program, they are using the postal, whatever you call it, like you see CA meaning California, but that sounds like what people who do not come from Boston think we say when we say car. They think we say car. And you see TX for Texas, and TX is ticks, and that's something that gets in dogs under their skin and cats and things. And you see Massachusetts, MA, and that's Ma, and that's what I used to call my mother. And that's what you will see in the program is Bill C. M.A. Well, I come, my office is in Boston, Massachusetts, and I am living in Catawmut, which is on the Cape, and that is 5,275 feet lower than Denver. Now, on my wife's tag, it has Falmouth. She also lives in Catawmut with me. But just to point out one little thing and say just a couple of things, as I said I would take a few minutes at the end, is you have heard three people from three walks of life, and I am an attorney in Boston. And I would like to stop a rumor that I have heard here, because I met a lot of people from different places I have been since I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous and throughout this country and Canada, and they said, I heard you retired. Well, number one, I'm too damn young to retire, and number two, I can't afford it. And number three, it used to be when people went to live in the Cape that they were going down there to retire. But not anymore. It's to get away from the smog, the fog, and the air is lovely and clean down there. But I had a lot of trouble with alcohol. I didn't start drinking until after I had graduated from college, law school, was in the Navy, and was getting out. And it was on a doctor's advice that I drank. And I'm not going through anything about my drinking. I had a lot of trouble, and I wound up 18 years ago sleeping on the Boston Common and standing in lines at missions and begging and borrowing and stealing. And I went to jail for non-support, and I was in hospitals. And all these things I say, not because I'm proud of it, but to show what alcohol did to me and why I am so grateful for all the people that are here, for all the people that came before me and all those that have come since. But more particularly to two people who are no longer with us. Certainly Bill W., Bill Wilson, whom I did know when I was a delegate and served on the Board of Trustees. I am so grateful that he met Ebby and Ebby came to his house, and poor Ebby, dear Ebby, passed away in 1966. For him I am grateful, for what he brought to Bill and to Dr. Bill Silkworth, for what he did in keeping Bill and taking care of him in the town's hospital in New York. To him I am very grateful. And to Dr. Bob, who had his last drink in June of 1935. And at that time, when Bill was there and had been with him for some time, and when Dr. Bob came back after being at that AMA convention, how Bill went with him, sat with him all that night, and went with him that day, while Dr. Bob performed an operation, and he gave him one bottle of beer. And that was the last drink that Dr. Bob had. And when those two came together, this beautiful fellowship that we have was formed. And without it, I would be dead. And for this, I know. I am so positive of it. I am so grateful to others who, certainly Sister Ignatia, who helped so much, Sam Shoemaker, Henry Thiebaud, all three, Sister Ignatia, Henry Thiebaud, and Ebby died in that year of 1966. And certainly to Vern Smith, also with whom I became, I believe, a friend, because he too was on the Board of Trustees at the time I was, and he had been of service long before that. Without these people coming before me and becoming before many of you, what would we have? How many of us would be alive? How can I help but say thank you to all of IAA, all of you lovely people who came up here carrying the flag from your various countries? What a beautiful, beautiful sight that was, as the spotlights were on you and your flag. And I was kidding when I said about Ireland alone. I meant it for all of you. This program, through two people starting out 40 years ago, has spread to 91 countries. And starting from two people, it is now estimated at being very close to 1 million. And this can only be a guess. How fantastic that is. To all of you people, I say thank you for returning me to society, being able to go back to my profession, being able to stand on my own 2 feet, look anybody in the eye, and not be afraid anymore, for giving me back my self-respect. We will close this meeting in the usual manner, but a little differently, because we have a charming trustee who is also from the state of Massachusetts, only she's from the western part of the state. And she is the General Service Trustee, United States. Margaret, would you lead us in the Lord's Prayer?
One of the most beautiful parts of all of the AA meetings I've ever attended has been when we sober alcoholics have joined our hearts and our voices in the Lord's Prayer. And tonight, when we end this largest of all meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope that all of us will remember our founders, Bill and Dr. Bob. And tonight, as we gather from all over the world, and as we say the Lord's Prayer in all different languages, but with the same voice, I hope that we can remember that we now are the founders of what AA is to become. And I hope we can pledge tonight, through these words, to let it begin with me. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.